Fritz Umbach, and I'm a professor of world history with the City University of New York. Welcome to this audio tour of the Afro-European encounter in Africa at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. When you hear the beep, pause the tour until you have reached the next destination. Before we begin, please proceed to the large map of Africa just as you walk into the Arts of Africa exhibit. This tour uses material culture, that is, the physical objects people of different societies make and use, to take a broad look at the changing nature of the encounter between Africans and Europeans from the 15th to the 19th centuries. Many of the artifacts you are about to see are aesthetically beautiful and can be appreciated for just that reason. But there is another reason to look closely at these items. Objects made or modified by humans reflect the belief patterns of the individuals who made, commissioned, purchased, or used them, and so reveal the world view of the larger society of which they are a part. So these objects, crafted by Africans over a 500-year period, can tell us a great deal about the African perspective on the early encounter between Africans and Europeans. This tour synthesizes the scholarship of many specialists in Africa, Europe, and the United States. Indeed, I have borrowed quite liberally from their work, and portions of what you are about to hear are taken directly from them. The last track contains a detailed bibliography. A few warnings, however, before we begin. I'll start with my own title for the tour. In some ways, calling it the Afro-European encounter in Africa is misleading. The inhabitants of the continent of Africa at this time didn't think of themselves as being African. Indeed, the idea of Africa itself would have been meaningless to them. Rather, their identities were far more local. Likewise, Europeans were only beginning to develop a sense of themselves as Europeans, distinct from other groups. So while it might make sense from our perspective to think of an Afro-European encounter at this time, the participants of that encounter thought about it in very different terms. We will pick up this topic a little later in our discussion. Next, while you often hear of this or that ethnicity or tribe in Africa, the Igbo, for example, these so-called tribes are really an invention of the colonial period of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The inhabitants of pre-colonial Africa did not belong to tribes, but instead had much more fluid and inclusive identities, formed by many aspects of their lives. Europeans, however, assumed that Africans had the same identity with tribe as Europeans had with ethnicity. English, Irish, French, etc. Colonial administrators, for their own convenience, imposed tribal designations on the Africans under their jurisdiction, and over time, the new identities came to take on a reality of their own. So Africa today can seem to outsiders as downright tribal, but these groupings, and sometimes hostilities, don't extend very far into the past. This means that when looking at who made a certain object, we have to be careful not to project a current tribal identity back onto the past. Finally, I will refer to some African empires, Ghana and Mali, for example, that have the same name as modern-day African countries. Don't think, however, of these countries as the direct descendants of such empires. Their borders and cultural makeups are often quite different. All of this can be confusing, I know, but illustrates an important lesson. The past is a different place, and we need to take it on its own terms, not our own. Now, looking at the map, we will be talking about objects from modern-day Mali, Mauritania, Ghana, Nigeria, Benin, Sierra Leone, the Congo, Angola, and Ethiopia. Our story follows a roughly chronological path, but the Met is organized by region, so there will be a fair amount of jumping around from case to case. Begin by walking along the wall on which the map appears until just before the doorway to the right that leads out of the Africa exhibit. Stop at the case labeled Western Sudan. When you get there, proceed to the next track. Contrary to a modern myth, which sees Africa as largely isolated from the outside world until recently, Africa was deeply integrated into world trade systems and their cultural influences from at least the 9th century. To understand how Africa became an important center of world trade, we have to step back and look at what was arguably the most dynamic force in the world between the 8th and the 11th centuries, the expansion of Islam. In the century after Muhammad's death in 632, Muslim Arabs expanded out of their homelands and conquered most of the Middle East and North Africa, as well as most of what is now Spain and Portugal. Muslim armies also took much of northern India and Central Asia as well. By the 9th century, Arab and Persian sailors directly connected East Africa, India, Southeast Asia, and China. The economic consequences of these conquests were dramatic. The Muslim world, stretching from northwest Africa to India, was tied into a vast commercial complex. Unprecedented quantities of East Asian goods flowed westward, while East African goods moved north and east. But to finance this commercial expansion, Muslims needed bullion, precious metals whose value would be accepted in many different places. They found it south of the Sahara Desert, in the gold deposits of Africa's western savanna. To gain access to this gold in the 8th and 9th centuries, Arab traders significantly expanded earlier commercial links that tied West Africa to the larger world. Two-thirds of the world's gold supply at this time came from Africa, and countless industries, from Italian olive oil to Chinese pottery, required the financial investment and commercial lubrication African gold provided. West Africa, then, both made global trade in this period possible and was in turn shaped by it. The trade networks obviously had significant political consequences. Those who were able to control the transfer points between the forest lands in the south and the desert regions in the north acquired wealth and power. This process gave rise to Africa's three famous grassland kingdoms, Ghana, Mali, and Songhai. Such trade also brought cultural changes. The objects in this case speak to those changes. Looking at the objects in the case marked Western Sudan, you will see a 19th century window from Mali with an arch clearly influenced by Islamic culture. This object testifies to the significant impact Islam had in West Africa. Islam here spread more by trade than the sword. Merchants and rulers, who often had contacts that reached far beyond their local experience, needed a cosmopolitan worldview rather than one tied to a specific place, as had been the case with many African religions celebrating local deities and ancestors. African elites found just such a worldview in Islam, and so were frequently the first to convert. The rulers of the Empire of Ghana converted in the 11th century, and those of Mali converted in the 13th century. With conversion came cultural influences. For example, the Malian king Mansa Musa brought back from his pilgrimage to Mecca Muslim architects who helped create a distinctive Islamic African building style in Mali that illustrates the broader blending of practices from the wider Islamic world and West Africa at this time. To the right of the Malian window, you will see a granary shutter, and this object helps tell the other side of the consequences of West Africa's connection to the larger trade networks. World trade did not benefit all societies equally, and those that derived neither wealth nor power from the commerce often fell prey to those who had. The Dogon peoples, who made the shutter, are a good example of this phenomenon. The Dogon fled their homeland sometime in the 15th or 16th century to inaccessible parts of what is now Mali and Burkina Faso in order to escape constant slave raiding by successive neighbors who had benefited more from the expansion of world trade. In this safe but difficult region, wealth took the form of hordes of agricultural staples like millet and sorghum that were critical to survival. And so the Dogon craftspeople often lavished their skills on the openings to granaries that held such reserves. We can see an example of such artistic attention in this shutter. Look for the rows of carved figures depicting ancestors. During the construction of the granaries, the Dogon addressed their ritual calls for protection to such carvings, asking ancestral spirits to intervene in the events of the physical world. In the case to the right, you will see a series of Dogon artifacts, many of which feature equestrian symbols. Horses died easily in this region, and those who owned them had to replenish their stocks frequently through trade with outsiders. Horses, accordingly, became a symbol of wealth and power throughout West Africa. You will also find a photograph of a Dogon structure, like the one that once held the granary shutter we examined earlier. Although the Dogon have hardly been impervious to outside influence, they have also been more successful than other African groups in retaining their culture, and have produced some of the most widely admired art of Africa. So you may want to spend some time looking at these objects. To continue the tour, turn around, walk across the hallway, past the sculpture of a couple from Madagascar in a self-standing case, through the entrance hallway labeled Benison Gallery, and continue through the next exhibit space until you reach the far wall. Look for the case labeled Nigeria but step a little to the right of the small locked door to a second case of objects from what is now Nigeria. Once you've reached that case, continue the tour. You will see in this case two brass rings, one lying down flat to the left and another placed vertically to the right. Rings of this kind have been found throughout the forest regions of West Africa. Here, heavy rains, poor soil, and a thick forest canopy that blocked the sun made growing enough food for complex, large societies far more difficult than the high grasslands where the empires of Ghana, Mali, and Songhai flourished. Difficult, but not impossible. In a testament to their ingenuity, the region's inhabitants managed to carve out both a handful of state-level societies, including a cluster of small polities known collectively as the Yoruba kingdoms, and, to the east, the much larger Benin kingdom. These rings displayed in this case provide insight into the nature of kingship and political authority in this region during the pre-colonial period. Look first to the ring lying down, from our Yoruba kingdom of the 16th century. The ring depicts four people. Notice that three of them have had their hands tied behind their backs and their heads severed. Their decapitated heads, still gagged, lie nearby. A vulture picks over their remains. These figures represent captives sacrificed in honor of the fourth figure, the king, clearly visible with his elaborate cone-shaped hat. We see the same symbols in the ring to the right, from 17th century Benin. Again, we find three gagged and severed heads next to three bound decapitated bodies. As in the first ring, vultures help themselves to the remains. A much larger figure, wearing much the same sort of hat as in the Yoruba ring, is not gagged, and again represents a ruler or oba rather than a sacrificial victim. Scattered between these figures are round pots, meant to hold water and herbal medicines. And so the ring's grisly mix of symbols underscores the king's dual nature. The victims remind us that the oba is a ruler with power over the life and death of his people, while the herbal medicine tell of his role as healer who commands supernatural forces. The scene in both rings recall the human sacrifices known to have been practiced in Benin as late as 1897. Performed infrequently, such sacrifices were momentous occasions designed to strengthen and protect an entire kingdom. After looking at the artifacts in the case, walk a little further, say 10 feet, to the right until you come to a self-standing case marked Afro-Portuguese ivories. The first Portuguese caravels edged down the Atlantic coast of Africa in the 1430s and 1440s, reaching the Senegal River by 1445, and so began a historic encounter for both Africans and Europeans. The Portuguese exploration of the African coast was an attempt to bypass Muslim middlemen and tap into the gold and spice trades at their sources. But how did these Portuguese and Africans see each other? Contrary to the popular myth of civilized Europeans overwhelming primitive Africans, the initial encounter between Portuguese sailors and African populations were for the most part peaceful and diplomatic. Notably absent from these encounters was any notion of race, an idea unknown in Europe at the time. Europeans, of course, noted physical differences, but they attached little significance to them. Only occasionally did Africans and Europeans see each other, or identify themselves, in terms of blackness and whiteness. When they did so, no notion of inherent superiority infused either term. And so the Europeans did not conceive of the Africans they encountered as their inferiors. And certainly, it would have been hard for them to have thought so. Aside from the European ships, there was a technological equality between the two groups. Both were pre-industrial, iron-working societies in which the family was the primary economic unit. Indeed, both groups assumed that they were dealing with their equals. And if both also tended to see the other as not particularly attractive, they soon overcame these initial impressions, as the many Afro-Portuguese marriages in the 15th and 16th centuries demonstrate. Such unions also underscore the many similarities between African and European cultures at this time. Both generally saw their monarchs as earthly representatives of heavenly authority. Both believed spirits lived among them, influencing events for good or ill, and both thought that such spirits, in turn, could be influenced by certain humans generally called witches. The Afro-Portuguese ivories before you testify to the respect Portuguese had for the abilities of the Africans they encountered, Portuguese explorers and traders were extremely impressed by the considerable talent of the ivory carvers along the west coast of Africa. Inspired by what they saw, Europeans commissioned African artisans to produce work of the kind you see in this case. These objects embody the initial Afro-European encounter by ingeniously combining European artistic styles and forms with those of Africa. The two objects in front of you are containers for salt and pepper, both costly commodities at the time. Such elaborate receptacles, then, were appropriate for storing spices in princely homes of Europe. The first of the two salt cellars features a globe and comes from the Sapi people of what is now Sierra Leone. The top half of the piece includes four delicate rosettes and is crowned by a distinctly European rose. The lower half includes imagery from African belief systems. The snakes refer to spirits who are believed to bring immense riches, alluding to the wealth gained through trade with the Portuguese. The four snakes appear to approach and almost touch noses with four growling dogs, with their hair bristling and ears laid back. According to Sapi tradition, dogs are spiritually astute animals, able to perceive spirits and ghosts invisible to humans, and here we see that supernatural ability portrayed. The four African figures along the base appear to be a series of attendants of no particular rank. The women rest their hands on their genitalia, emphasizing their fertility, while the men hold swords and shields. The second salt cellar, from 16th century Benin, features four bearded Portuguese men. Like many of the objects West Africans produce for their royalty and courts, this salt cellar, by a Benin ivory carver for a European client, emphasizes the details of the dress and symbols of noble status. Along the perimeter of the vessel, we see four Portuguese figures, two richly adorned men and their attendants. The higher status figures face outward. The attendants are in profile, more crudely rendered, and in motion. The two wealthier men are laden with symbols of their status. These include the pattern high-crowned hat with a feather decorating its brim, the knee breeches, a button jacket with flaring shoulders, sleeves and keys, crosses, swords, and spears. But when the Portuguese commissioned such objects, they not only brought European influences to Africa, they also carried African influences back to Europe. The delicate, beaded, braided, and twisted figures of these African carvings influenced the architecture of 16th century Portugal in a form of ornamentation called gadruning. The Portuguese would have a significant impact on the courtly arts of Benin. We will examine this phenomenon more closely in the next set of objects. Once you are done admiring these Afro-Portuguese ivories, walk towards the center of the room and place yourself in front of the rectangular case containing a large number of bronze plaques. Once you have located yourself in front of the rectangular case containing the plaques, move to the right of the case and look towards the top for a brass plate that features two Portuguese merchants with a series of rings below them. Because the Portuguese came from across the sea, bringing with them wealth and luxury items, the Edo people of Benin found it easy to integrate the Portuguese into the web of ideas and symbols they associated with the god Olokun, ruler of the seas, provider of earthly wealth. Cast or carved images of Portuguese sailors in 16th century clothing appear in a wide variety of artifacts from Benin, including bracelets, plaques, bells, pendants, masks, tusks, and so on. Usually in these objects, the Portuguese are accompanied by the characters from the world of the god Olokun, such as mudfish, crocodiles, and pythons, as well as a crowd of chiefs and nobles. And so the idea of the Portuguese, and representations of them, became a crucial part of the spiritual imagery of this West African people. This symbolic fusing of wealth with the Portuguese is neatly captured by the plaque with two Portuguese merchants with rings below them. These plaques once adorned a huge palace that was at the center of Edo royal life. The rings below the Portuguese merchants are known as manilas, a word that comes from the Portuguese for bracelet for the hand. Used as a currency even before the arrival of the Portuguese, the design of these C-shaped brass ingots likely originated in Africa, but the Portuguese began to produce them in quantity specifically for trading with Benin. And so, this plaque represents the association made by the Edo people of Benin between wealth and the Portuguese, who are depicted here with sharp noses, long hair, and unique dress. Contrary to the myth of powerful Europeans pushing aside helpless African peoples, the arrival of the Portuguese coincided with a period of great political and artistic development in Benin. No doubt, the monarch of Benin found the coming of the Portuguese a welcome event that suited his purposes. Portuguese mercenaries provided Benin with support against its enemies, while traders supplied the important luxuries Benin society craved, including coral beads, cloth for ceremonial attire, and great quantities of brass manillas that could be melted down for casting artifacts like the plaques you see before you. The association between the Portuguese, the god Olokun, and the power of the ruler of Benin, the Oba, took many forms. Because in Benin thought, the Oba defeats Olokun and seizes the god's wealth, the ability to travel between watery and earthly realms represents both political and spiritual power. The mudfish, which is able to live both on land and water, accordingly, took on associations of divine wealth and power. And the people of Benin linked the spiritual connotations of the mudfish with the Portuguese, who, with their ships, also seemed to travel between earthly and waterly worlds with ease. In the plaques below, notably the one with the rings and elsewhere in this exhibit, you can see the recurring image of the mudfish linked to the Portuguese. How these 16th and 17th century Benin bronzes came to Europe and America is a story from a time in Africa's history 400 years later, when the balance of power first slipped out of African hands and into European ones, the colonial era. By the late 1890s, the British were eager both to stop paying customs duties to a still independent Benin and to end the practices of slavery and human sacrifice that were part of that African kingdom's culture. Although the British had been active in the slave trade at the beginning of the 19th century, by the century's close, they took it upon themselves to end the practice in Africa, as part of what the British like to think of as their civilizing mission. It was a mission that also, conveniently, justified their colonial expansion. The acting Consul General for the region, James Phillips, sent this dispatch to the British Foreign Office in 1897.
I am certain there is only one remedy, and that is to depose the King of Benin. And I'm convinced that pacific measures are now quite useless, and that the time has now come to remove the obstruction. I do not anticipate any serious resistance from the people of the country. There is every reason to believe they would be glad to get rid of their king.
Phillips, ignoring warnings not to enter the kingdom during sacred religious ceremonies forbidden to outsiders, sent a party of British officials to the city. There, they were ambushed and killed. Disregarding the fact that it was they who had violated the Oba's rituals, the British took their revenge by pounding the kingdom with their new weapon, the Maxim gun, ending 6 centuries of the Oba's rule and looting hundreds of priceless artifacts that later entered the open market in Europe. In time, museums in England, Germany, and the United States acquired these objects. Some in the modern country of Nigeria, where the Kingdom of Benin once stood, have called for the bronzes' return, while other Nigerians argue that the bronzes and the legacy they represent are safer in museums abroad. Ironically, it was, in many ways, the looting of Benin that made Europeans take notice of African art. In the second half of the 19th century, Europeans, forgetting how impressive they once had found African artistic skill 300 years earlier, had come to dismiss the continent's cultures. The royal palace of Benin and the art it contained revealed a level of technical skill and aesthetic complexity that Africa, according to Victorian prejudices, wasn't supposed to be capable of producing. Europeans, accordingly, were mystified and amazed by the art from Benin. Growing appreciation of African art, however, hardly restrained British colonialism, and England continued to bring more of the continent under her subjugation. But when Africans made the objects in this room, they still very much had the upper hand in their dealings with Europeans. And, as we saw in the bronze plaques, the presence of Europeans benefited rather than hurt Benin's ruling Obas. It is no surprise, then, that the spiritual symbolism of Benin's people in this earlier period so often braided together the power of the god Olokun, the Oba, and the European travelers by blending imagery of the Portuguese with the mudfish. we will see an explicit and aesthetically stunning fusion of the symbols in the next object. To continue the tour, turn around and walk to the self-standing case containing just an ivory mask. Feel free, however, to look at the other plaques before continuing the tour. Considered a masterpiece of African art, this pendant mask is both a status object worn by the King of Benin on ceremonial occasions and the portrait of an important historical figure at the court. We know from the value of the material and the quality of the carving that it is the work of the exclusive guild of royal ivory carvers. Framed by an elegant tiara-like hair arrangement and open-work collar, this portrait of an Edo royal woman is in fact Idia, mother and close advisor to one of Benin's greatest leaders, Esigi, who ruled in the early 16th century. King Esigi of Benin honored Idia for helping secure his claim to the throne. As a consequence, the title of Queen Mother, Ioba, was introduced to the Benin court, granting the mother of the Oba equal authority to that of the senior town chiefs. The mask's white color refers to the god Olokun, ruler of the seas, while the mask's material, ivory, emphasizes the wealth brought by the sea and put at the disposal of the ruler. Look closely at the projections above the hair. You will see alternating images of Portuguese traders and mudfish. The miniature pattern of Portuguese faces symbolizes the extraordinary wealth generated in the Benin Kingdom in the 16th century through overseas trade with the Portuguese. Between the Portuguese faces are mudfish. By joining this frequent symbol of Benin's kingship to the Portuguese, the Oba publicly emphasized his close links to the wealth and power the Portuguese brought his land. The hollowed back of this work suggests that it was both a pendant and a container, possibly for medicines to protect the king during ceremonial occasions when he wore it around his neck. To continue the tour, turn directly behind you to the large T-shaped, self-standing case with large carved tusks. Once you are standing in the case with the tusks, look at the bottom of the case for a small rectangular bell. Take a moment to look closely at the bell. Brass bells are an essential feature of Benin ancestral altars. Arranged along the front of an altar, they are rung in order to call the ancestors to hear the prayers of their descendants and to partake of the offerings left there. Cast on the front of this bell, you will notice the face of a Portuguese man, distinguished by the beak-like nose, thinly rimmed eyes, and long, stringy hair that Benin craftsmen used to represent Europeans. This Portuguese man also wears an elaborately decorated hat with a fish-scale design and two feathers. On the other sides of the bell, you will see leaf-shaped swords, emblems of leadership that the Oba and important chiefs carried at palace ceremonies. This imagery tells us that the ancestral altar with which this bell was associated possessed significant status. But why the imagery of the Portuguese at an altar where dutiful descendants summoned departed ancestors? According to the Edo world view, the worlds of the living and the dead are separated by a vast body of water. The movements of the Portuguese across the Atlantic Ocean were thought of by Benin's people as bridging these two distinct spheres of existence, and so the image of the Portuguese represented for the Edo the communication with the supernatural that took place at ancestral altars. By a rather early date, then, in Benin's history, the ritualistic communication with one's ancestors, so central to the spiritual life of the kingdom, employed both the idea of the Portuguese and representations of them. You might want to take some time to look at the other artifacts in this case before moving on. One of the great myths of the European encounter with Africa, particularly in regards to the slave trade, is that a few drunken chiefs traded away their people for worthless trinkets. In reality, the Portuguese had a struggle to find goods the Africans desired sufficiently to be willing to part with any of the things the Portuguese wanted. European fabrics, made from wool, for example, hardly appealed to African buyers who preferred cloth made from palm fibers, cotton, or silk. Beyond the Manilas already discussed, the one thing the Portuguese had to offer was their ships, which were among the best in the world. So they put their ships to work hauling African goods from one part of Africa to another, in addition to conducting an exchange of goods between Europe and Africa. You might want to think of the Portuguese in this period as primarily the truck drivers of African trade. For example, the Portuguese carried cloth from Benin to what is now modern Ghana in return for gold. It is artifacts from this region that we will now turn. If you follow the T-shaped case with the tusks around its edge closest to the far wall, you will eventually come to a case with a sign, Akan Gold. For this portion of the tour, I am joined by my colleague, Dr. Kojo Day, an anthropologist with the City University of New York and a native of Ghana.
During the 16th and 17th centuries, in the region of Africa that is now modern Ghana, a cluster of competing kingdoms flourished among the Akan peoples. They had long traded with the grassland empires to the north, exchanging their gold for salt and other commodities. This trade across the Saharan desert exposed the Akan to the influence of Islamic culture, even though there were few converts among them. We can see evidence of this influence in the Kukuo containers in this case. Look closely at these containers. They were the possessions of kings and nobles in the Akan kingdoms. Gold dust and nuggets were kept in Kukuo, as were other items of personal value and significance. The technology of locked wax casting used in these Kukuos came from the Western Sudan in the North Akan area over 600 years ago, brought by the Mande, an Islamicized group that specialized in trading. The Akan metal workers adapted Islamic styles for their most important type of container, the Kukuo. In particular, the Akan borrowed from ships used by the Mamluks, an Islamic dynasty in Egypt. Indeed, at least six containers manufactured in Muslim Mamluk Egypt still do service today in northern Akan shrines as sacred objects, despite the sharp differences in religion. The repeating bands of geometric patterns notched into the surface, as well as the elegantly flaring feet, bodies, and handles reveal the Islamic influences on these two Kukuos from what is now Ghana. As receptacles for their owner's kra, or life force, Kukuos were prominent features of ceremonies designed to honor and protect that individual. At the time of his death, a person's Kukuo was filled with gold and other offerings and included in an assembly of items left at the burial site. Look now to the pectoral badge in the case. It's a small disc about 5.5 inches across, placed upright. Luxurious cutlery arts wrought in gold are the prized emblems of leadership of the Akan peoples, and the Asante kingdom in particular. The gold deposits in Akan homelands had helped fuel world trade in the 10th century, bringing wealth to the region and acquiring a privileged place in Akan culture. By the mid-18th century, the Asante kingdom had unified this region and asserted its control over trade in gold, textiles, and slaves. The Asante's remarkable wealth and power were symbolized by the extraordinary rich art traditions produced for the Akan rulers. In Akan thought, gold is considered an earthly counterpart to the sun and the physical manifestation of life's vital force, or kra. Cast gold discs called Soul Master's Discs are worn as protective emblems by important members of the court. The Asante employed Muslim amulet makers and record keepers, perhaps as early as the 16th century. The influence of these Muslim amulet makers is visible in this soul washer's disc. The central rosette, surrounded by a circular border of repeating motifs of vegetation mirrors patterns from Islamic North Africa, a region intimately linked to the Ashanti Kingdom through the gold trade. Such rosettes are common in leather work across West Africa and come from motifs common in Islamic North Africa that protects against the evil eye. In time, the Ashanti would leverage their control over trade with the Europeans to dominate their neighbors and would use that political power to become a significant supplier of slaves to the New World. But before the mid-17th century, the Ashanti and the other Akan kingdoms actually imported more slaves from other parts of Africa than they sold to Europeans. Akan tradition at this time forbade freeborn persons from working in the gold industry, perhaps to restrict the industry to those wealthy enough to own slaves. This tradition obliged the Akan kingdoms to import slaves. The Portuguese were only too happy to meet that demand and use their ships to transport slaves to the Akan from the Congo Kingdom in Africa. Our last subject, then, will be from the Congo Kingdom.
To get to the Congo Kingdom object, return to the Afro-Portuguese ivories case and keep walking towards the far wall, stopping just before you reach the fabrics on the wall. You will see a self-standing case that rises to just about table height, labeled Central African Power Objects. In the case, you will see a crucifix, a cross, with a Christ figure. Twice the size of New York State, the Congo Kingdom was one of the largest in sub-Saharan Africa at the time. One could travel from the Atlantic Ocean in the west to the Kwango River in the east, and from the Congo River in the north to the Kwanza River in the south without ever leaving the kingdom. Ruling over this 115,000 square miles of territory was the Manikongo, the monarch of the Congo, and his powerful nobles. They paid for their luxurious lifestyle by taxing the rural population. The kingdom also prospered from trade. Besides a lively traffic in natural products like ivory and salt, the country's metal workers manufactured coppered wares for export, while weavers and dyers fashioned its famous raffia cloth that fetched high prices in foreign markets. Even the slave trade flourished long before contact with Europeans. The Portuguese arrival profitably enlarged the kingdom's exports by linking African producers with European consumers. Indeed, like the salt sellers from earlier in the tour, raffia cloth from the Congo became much admired in 16th century Europe, and a Portuguese painting of the Annunciation from the time portrays the Virgin kneeling on raffia cloth with an embroidered Congo design. Perhaps to solidify these trading relationships with their new partners, in 1491, the King of the Congo converted to Christianity of his own free will and urged his people to follow suit. The Congo remained more or less Christian for the next 200 years, and the kingdom's leaders exchanged many letters with rulers and religious officials in Europe, including even the Pope. Usually, we think of Christian icons in Central Africa as evidence of missionaries shouldering aside African beliefs in favor of Christianity. But the cross before you shows you that there was a much earlier relationship between leaders of pre-colonial Congo and their European counterparts. The earliest Congo crucifixes depict Christ naturalistically, with his face revealing signs of a painful death, much like European crucifixes at the time. However, later examples of crucifixes from the Congo, such as the one in this case, suggest a more profound blending of the Christian cross with local African symbols. On the crucifix in front of you, Christ's hair has been modeled from a Congolese rather than a European subject, and the figure's facial features have been reduced and stylized. His hands and feet are flattened, and the feet are joined into a single five-toed limb. According to Congo religious thought, such a limb represents heightened spiritual power. Notice Christ's large, protruding oval eyes, a common theme in Congo art that indicates the supernatural vision of a human possessed by an ancestor or deity. Below Christ and above his shoulders are small, highly stylized praying figures that represent ancestors. And so this cross reveals the extent to which the Congolese incorporated local ancestor worship into Christianity. The Congolese considered the Christian cross an emblem of spiritual authority and power, so they used it in traditional Congolese ancestral cults and burial rituals. the Congolese believed that crosses had power over illness, fertility, and even rainfall. So rather than European Christianity displacing a traditional African religion, it enriched the collection of symbols and ideas used in Congolese spiritual life, producing a new synthesis. While the tour of the Afro-European encounter in Africa ends here, you might want to compare this Congo cross with the illuminated gospel and processional cross from the Lake Tana region of Ethiopia. Those artifacts represent a different tradition of Christianity within Africa that speaks to sub-Saharan Africa's long-standing and complex relationships with the Arabian Peninsula, Egypt, and the Eastern Mediterranean. Both the illuminated gospel and the cross can be found in a self-standing case near the Dogon objects discussed at the beginning of this tour. And so ends the tour. After the music, there's a learning activity and a brief bibliography. In this learning activity, you will imagine that you are a historian of African material culture who is trying to figure out the relationship between two cultures through the objects from those cultures. To start the activity, walk to the case labeled on the map as Owo Lidded Bowl. Continue the tour once you are standing in front of the lidded bowl. Look for an egg-shaped vessel connected to a circular base by a short stem. Owo is a town about 70 miles north of Benin. Elephants were at one time abundant in the forest surrounding Owo and had supplied ivory to Benin. Owo and Benin, then, were neighboring societies. What can material culture tell us about how culturally similar or dissimilar they were? We will look at religious and political symbols and ornamentation, as well as patterns of portraying human facial features. First, recall from earlier in the tour the animals associated with the god Olokun in Benin, as well as the powers of the king portrayed in the 17th century brass ring from Benin. Next, imagine that you know from documents that the figures on the lidded bowl all express in some way the powers possessed by Owo's ruler. Start your close examination of the Owo lidded bowl by looking at it from above. You'll see a figure of a snake that emerges from the center of the bowl and wraps around the edge of the vessel. As you follow the snake's body, look closely at how the figure ends. Write down your observations. Next, looking at the bowl head-on, you'll see the ruler himself portrayed. What animal is he holding in his hands? In turn, what are those animals holding in their mouths? Keep in mind what you know about the god Olokun from Benin as you make your observations. Next, look very closely at how the artisan has portrayed the king's facial features, including his lips and eyes. Write down your observations so that you can compare them later to the portrayal of facial features from Benin. Now, take what you have observed about the rendering of facial features at Owo and look again to the ivory pendant mask from Benin. What's different and what's the same? Use your observations to answer the question your professor has provided you. I have conceived of this tour as a reading packet, like you might have for a course. That is, I've assembled excerpts from various texts and read portions of them to you, modifying and combining the text as needed to create a seamless narrative. Accordingly, I have borrowed quite liberally. For material on the role of Africa in the world economy, I have drawn heavily from Donald Wright's The World and a Very Small Place in Africa, particularly Chapter 1, as well as Eric Wolf's Europe and the People Without History. For the early relationship between the Portuguese and the African populations they encountered, I used Gilbert and Reynolds' Africa in World History, particularly chapters 8 and 9. For the history of the Dogon and the Akan, I relied on the relevant entries from the Encyclopedia of World Cultures, Volume 9, Africa and the Middle East. For the particularities of individual objects, I used the Met's own card catalog, the special topics section of the Met's Timeline of Art History, as well as two superb publications from the museum, The Royal Art of Benin and The Art of the Pacific Islands, Africa, and the Americas. The various writings of the Met's curator, Emma George Ross, have been invaluable for my discussion of the Congo. For additional details regarding Asante and Benin courtly arts, I use two now standard texts for the field, Weller's African Art and A History of Art in Africa by Vizona and others. For details regarding the influence of the Afro-Portuguese ivories on Portuguese architecture, I relied upon Jerry Broughton, The Renaissance Bazaar, From the Silk Road to Michelangelo. To counteract the bias of histories crafted from written sources, I consulted Peter Mitchell's African Connection, Archaeological Perspectives on Africa and the Larger World. The audio dispatch for the British Consul in Benin comes from a splendid set of radio programs produced by the BBC entitled The Story of Africa. Of all the books just mentioned, Gilbert and Reynolds' African World History is perhaps the best introduction to the field for non-specialists.